Could you share with us some of your favorite stories from the book?
Sure. There's a guy in my book. It's chapter 3, I believe. I call him Ladies' Man. His name is Mike Koza. And he's a guy in Sacramento. He's a civil engineer. And for most of his life, Mike could care less about investing. His passion was whitewater rafting. That's what he liked to do. But he was kind of lonely, and he decided, I'm going to look for a wife. And he went to the personal ads, and he found a woman named Maria, who is a Filipina immigrant, who came from poverty. And she met with Mike. They kind of hit it off. And she noticed that Mike had this portfolio, about $100,000 that he had saved. He was about 40 years old. And it was going nowhere. He had a broker at Morgan Stanley charging him fees, but the portfolio was not really going anywhere. And she said, you know, what's the matter with you? You're really smart. Why don't you just invest on your own? I heard, you know, you can do really well if you do that. And he kind of was skeptical, but he said, okay, I'm going to try that. And so Mike hunkered down. He's a really bright guy. You know, one of these guys who gets like a perfect math SAT, and he's become this amazing value stock investor where he's been really good at calculating kind of intrinsic values of companies, worst case scenarios, and coming up with his own valuations on companies. And he's turned that $100,000 into more than $3 million in about 9 years because he's just, you know, he read books like Ben Graham's The Intelligent Investor and several other classics, and he just taught himself to be a great investor. So Mike Koza's story is one of my favorites because, and I call him Ladies' Man because if it wasn't for his wife and his wife's urging, Mike would have never realized his potential as an investor. So Mike's is a great story for me. You mentioned there's a guy named Kai Patanen who I mentioned in my book, and he is a computer lab manager at the University of Michigan. University of Michigan's Business School. And I call him the Sorcerer's Apprentice because Kai soaked in what the professors at the school were talking about for years. And he researched academic theories just as a computer lab manager. And what he did is he created his own formula for quantitative investing. And what I mean by that is that he screens for stocks based on certain quantitative properties, and he's become an outstanding investor. I mean, he's created 9 portfolios on Marketocracy, and I believe all but one of them has far outpaced its benchmark. And so, you know, Kai's a real interesting story because he's a guy who just, you know, because of his day job, he's learned to be a great investor, and it's very inspirational. There's another, do you want me to tell you another one, or are we good with that?
Absolutely, go ahead.
There's another investor who I write about. His name is Jack Whalen, and Jack, he's the kind of guy who nobody would ever have hired him for any kind of Wall Street job. He dropped out of college. He was in the Army. He was in the Air Force for a little bit. He's had a real problem in his life with stick-to-itiveness. What Jack ended up doing is Jack discovered he became a truck driver, and he discovered that he had a knack for picking biotech and healthcare stocks. And Jack would, while he was on his trucker route, there was the Department of Transportation has these mandatory rests that all truckers need to take. And so whenever Jack would take his mandatory rest from his truck route, he would log on to the web and use a 3G wireless card on his laptop and research stocks. And over the years, he's made himself an expert on biotech stocks using a number of web resources. On Marketocracy, his average annual return as of the time I wrote my book was about 36% on average per year, investing in biotech stocks mostly. And so Jack he's an interesting guy because he's a guy who, it's not that easy for him to articulate what he does, but when you start asking him specifics about drugs and pharmaceuticals and biotechs, you know, he has this amazing ability to remember detail and financial detail and detail about drugs and FDA trials, and he's just, you know, he's become an outstanding investor. It's the talent that, you know, Jack Whalen has discovered that he has.
Do you think that Wall Street will look to pick up some of these new types of investors and bring them into their companies?
Absolutely. And in fact, I already know of one of the people who I wrote about in my book who was offered a money management job at a major asset manager. So I do think that these guys will get attention that perhaps we're not looking for. I mean, some of the guys in my book, some of them are young, like Jack Whalen and Kai Patanen, but others are retirees and, you know, who are living idyllic, you know, great lifestyles based on their ability to invest. And so some of those, you know, the retirees, I don't think any of them are looking for, you know, new careers as money managers. But I do think there'll be some on Wall Street will certainly give these guys a chance.
Well, now that we've addressed the you've never heard of part of the title, what exactly can we learn from the subjects of your book?
Well, I think that if you read my book, you'll see that there are some common themes that run throughout. I'd say the vast majority of the investors in my book are value investors. So they look for stocks that are somehow being mispriced by the market. And one of the common threads I found is that a lot of these guys, they look at big gainers and big losers every day. They're looking for stocks that have, where there's some market overreaction, where a stock has been unfairly punished, or on the other side, if it's kind of moved up irrationally. One of the guys who I mentioned, Mike Koza, the guy in Sacramento, the ladies man guy, he, for example, during the financial crisis, he did the analysis on a company called Radian Group, whose shares had gone as low as $1 a share. But Mike, who, plowed through their financial statements and kind of did a worst case scenario analysis and realized that, there's no way that this company, even under a liquidation scenario, would be less than $25 a share. So he, he bought a lot of Radian Group down near $1 a share. He didn't wait till it got to 25 to sell. I think he sold at something like 16 or something like that. But that's, that's an example of, somebody who takes advantage of, mispricing anomalies in the market. There's another guy I profile whose specialty is producing income from options, and I'll probably be writing about him in Forbes pretty soon. And one of his rules is, don't become emotionally tied to any stocks. I think that most of us, when we invest two currencies in a stock. We invest our dollars, our real currency, and then we invest emotional currency. You've done the research. You think this stock is really good because you believe that you're right. But the best investors, have discipline and they don't become emotional about the stocks. Don't fall in love with the stocks that you buy. And so as a rule, this investor, I believe his rule was, if something goes against him significantly, I think it might have been 20 or 25%, he's out. He will sell that stock. So there's a lot of these rules. Each one of my chapters has case studies and has rules that investors can learn, about investing. Rules that will help them become better investors.
Has the experience writing the book changed the way you view investing in Wall Street at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, frankly, if I didn't have to work my day job so hard at Forbes, I would love to, invest my own money myself and, spend the time. What I'm saying in this book is that we all need to spend time on, one of our most important assets. I mean, if you've ever bought a home, that everybody spends a lot of time researching the house they're going to buy. They look at it. They get people. They get experts, do inspections. But when it comes to our portfolios, we're always like, we hand the keys to someone else, and we're like, good luck. Hope you can make it grow. So, I think that people need to spend more time on their own, their own portfolios, their own retirements, their own nest eggs. And, I think you can learn from the people in my book about that. So, me personally, I envy a lot of the lives of the people who I wrote about. Some of these guys, one of the guys I wrote about, he lives this idyllic life in New Mexico. He built his own house based on the profits he has from investing in stocks. And he just has a great life where he invests his portfolio for like half the day, and then the rest of the day he has, he does what he wants to do. So there's stories like that in my book. And if anyone wants to see videos on some of these videos from that these, some of the people in my book have taped for me, they can go to mattschifrin.com and you'll see videos of some of the Warren Buffett's next door explaining a little bit about their investment styles. They're also on Forbes.com as well. If you go to blogs.forbes.com/Schifrin.
All right, Matt, we're giving you the loudspeaker now to break any news, call attention to anything you think is not getting sufficient attention, or just sound off on any issue you really care about.
No, I mean, I think, it's kind of what I've been saying. I think that most of us have to kind of stop listening to other people who tell us that we can't become better investors, that our financial future is better left to the professionals. I've met these professionals. I meet them all the time because they all want stories in Forbes, and I can tell you they're no smarter than most of us. And I can tell you that now more than ever, you can learn to be a great investor. And I think that my book, The Warren Buffett's Next Door, shows you living proof of people who are ordinary people who now have extraordinary investment returns and have created ideal lifestyles for themselves as a result.
All right, now that we've got all the hard questions out of the way, we have a few more lighthearted questions we ask all our first-time guests on Zing Talk. What was your first and what was your worst job?
You know, if you include my paper route when I was a kid, that was probably my first. But I had my worst job was one summer I worked at a sunglass factory, which was mind-numbingly boring. I am fortunate in that I've worked at Forbes pretty much since I graduated from college, and that's been a great job for me. I wouldn't say it's a worst at all in that regard. Definitely more of a best. You know, that's pretty much in terms of the jobs, that's where I stand.
Tell us something about yourself that no one has asked you about in an interview before.
That's good. Let's see. I don't have that many interviews. You know, I doubt anyone's going to ask me, you know, what my hobbies are. I like to do digital photography, and I play guitar, and I enjoy guitar. So, and my son plays guitar, too, so we play together. So that's some stuff I enjoy.
That was actually going to be my next question, ironically, what your hobbies were.
I play guitar, and I listen to music, and I do some photography. I play some tennis every now and then, and I'm interested in kind of biblical archaeology, so I do a little reading in that area.
What are some of your favorite bands?
Well, I'm a big Elvis Costello fan. It'd be my top.
All right. This last one is Ben Zinga's trademark question. What was the best and what was the worst investment decision that you've ever made?
When I was at the end of my college years, one of the worst investments, and I learned a lesson here, was I bought the stock of a company that I was very, the company was called Verbatim. They made floppy disks. This was in the mid-80s. And I was convinced that was a great company. Unfortunately, the market wasn't agreeing with me. But the funny thing was that the stock got taken over by Kodak, and I was one of the few people to lose a significant amount of money on a takeover play, where I think, you know, I only invested $2,000, and I think I lost $1,000 of it. So that was not a good thing. And I've had some good investments. I invested in GameStop many years ago, you know, the video game store, and I quadrupled my money in that. And that was, you know, it's funny, it was a Peter Lynch type investment where I saw my 8-year-old playing video games all the time, and I'm like, wow, this is just like so powerful that you know, it's not like a movie where you spend 3 hours watching it. I mean, my son would spend hours, and I'd be like, and so I did more research on the company. You know, I looked at the SEC documents, and then I realized that they had a big magazine and a big list of over 2 million subscribers. I started looking at the company. I'm like, wow, this is a really good buy. And I think I bought it before they merged with EB Games and before kind of all those new consoles came out, like the Wii. And so that was a great ride for me. Another good investment that I made was Apple. I have Apple stock, and that's been awesome.
And thank you. That'll do it for this episode of Zing Talk. Remember to check out www.benzinga.com for more market-moving news, actionable trading ideas, and insightful commentary.
You've been listening to part 2 of Zing Talk's exclusive podcast interview with Matt Shiffrin, Vice President and Investment Editor for Forbes, and also the author of The Warren Buffett's Next Door. Be sure to subscribe to Zing Talk in iTunes. You can find a link to do that on the Benzinga homepage. The music that you're listening to is Beethoven Virus by Banya and is available on the Internet Archive. All Benzinga podcasts are released under Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.5 license, and all other rights are reserved.